Okay, you'll those were here last week. Again, apologies for rushing out early. You'll be happy to know that I made it more or less on time. Everything was calm. I was a few minutes late, but I was okay with it. So I'm making progress. just a couple of housekeeping announcements before we go. Just if I could just ask everyone a favor, first of all, when you leave today. I'll just try to say as nicely as possible, but our neighbor's in one of her moods. a friendly neighbor. Upstairs, isn't it? I'm not going to go into details, but if I could just ask everyone when they leave, don't congregate outside. Just over here, you can talk as much as you want, you can stay as long as you want, but just when you go outside, don't congregate, because she's got all kinds of complaints and she needs to calm down. Okay. Also, I really appreciate that people not parking. We shouldn't congest the parking over here so that you found parking. I myself actually parked on O'Sullivan Road today. Wow. A little bit of extra walking, I guess, won't do any harm. So, just to keep it a bit empty and quiet outside, etc. If you know anyone who wants to buy an apartment upstairs, let me know. you can have the naming rights on the whole building. Okay. Just a quick review of last week, and I want to add something that we didn't manage to do last week, and then we'll go into today's topic. So last week we talked about the simanim, the codes. We talked about the codes that we eat on Rosh Hashanah, particularly we went into apple and honey, and we spoke about different ideas. One of the ideas we spoke about towards the end is the concept of apple. Apple being the symbol of commitment and honey being the symbol of understanding. And we spoke about true growth. The true growth begins with commitment. Commitment where we are able to go beyond ourselves, even if doesn't talk to us or doesn't gel with us, or we don't quite understand it yet. But that's real growth. Real growth means we prepare to do that once in a while because we're prepared to go a little bit beyond ourselves. Because if we grow, but we only grow in the context of where it makes sense to us, that's not really leaving ourselves, as we spoke about last week at length. But at the same time, we know that the Torah puts tremendous emphasis on understanding, because understanding is internalization. When we understand, we're fully there, we're doing it with our whole being, our heart, our head, and so on and so forth. So that's the combination, one of the ideas we spoke about last week, the apple and the honey. So that's just connected to something else that I wanted to quickly share with you, which I think I've done in the past, but I'll just share it with you in the context of last week's discussion, that on the second night of Rosh Hashanah, there's different customs, but there are many communities who have a custom not to eat the simanim on the second night, only on the first night. Right? Now, there's different customs, and each custom has its own journey and understanding, but there are many communities that have a custom not to eat the apple and honey or the pomegranate or the head of the fish or all these things on the second night, only the first night. And one of the ideas behind it is the following. I'll just take you through a very brief Kabbalistic idea. So, Kabbalistically, we are taught that the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, we know Rosh Hashanah is 2 days, even in Israel, unlike other festivals. But one of the ideas of the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah is that they correspond to Leah and Rachel, the two wives of Yaakov, right? We normally call them Rachel and Leah, but Leah was older, Leah came first, Leah and Rachel. And the first day corresponds to Leah. As we know, Leah, I think I've shared this with you before, Leah is the idea of more something mystical and thought, potential, and Rachel is more communication, practical. So the first day of Rosh Hashanah corresponds to Leah, and the second day to Rachel. Now, there's a fascinating midrash about Rachel and Leah. We know that when Jacob, Yaakov, came to the house of Lavan, his father-in-law, he met Rachel, and he actually wanted to marry Rachel, and he worked, as the biblical story goes, he worked for 7 years in order to marry Rachel. But his father-in-law was a real gangster, a con man. And at the last minute, in the dark of the night, instead of bringing Rachel into the marriage context, he brought Leah, the older sister, right? And as the Pasuk tells us, the next morning, behold, it's Leah, it's not Rachel. So the whole thing, he was very upset with him, and he said, don't worry, you'll work another 7 years. In the meantime, I'll give you ahead of time, in a week's time after the celebration, you can marry Rachel as well, and that's what happened. But that's the biblical story, but there's a fascinating midrash on that story. It tells us the following. That Yaakov knew that this might happen. He had a suspicion it might happen. Because he, in the 7 years he was working for his father, he got to know him well. He knew that this is a guy that you can't trust. Right? So ahead of time, the Midrash says, he gave Rachel codes, like a code, which the Midrash calls simanim. Also, simanim means a code, right? He gave some sort of codes that in the dark of the night, when she's brought in, he'll ask her the codes, and she'll say the codes, so he'll know that it's Rachel. He'll be sure, right? What actually happened at the end? As this was all happening, the wedding's happening, Rachel sees that Lavan, her father, is taking Leah instead. And she knew that what's going to happen is that Yaakov's going to ask for the codes, she's not going to know them, and she will be hugely humiliated. So she gave up everything. At that moment, she had no idea that she would still marry Yaakov, who she really wanted to marry. And this not was just, it wasn't only a physical thing, it was also the spiritual destiny of Jewish people. So much was at stake. And she gave it all up, and she gave the simanim to Leah so that she wouldn't be humiliated. And it was a moment of unbelievable selflessness. So therefore, to remember that, but maybe not just to remember that, to remind us about our commitment to Rosh Hashanah to try and be more selfless, as we spoke about in the context of growth, like to work on our ego, to be less about ourselves, and so on and so forth. On the second night, on the first night, we eat the simanim. On the second night, we don't eat the simanim. Like I said, that in itself is a custom. Not eating the simanim, to remember, because the second night is Rachel, and she gave the simanim to Leah, which is the first night. So that's why the second night, we don't eat them, because it was given away to the first night. It was given away to Leah. And we ask God, in the merit of her selflessness, we should be blessed. And of course, again, it's also a reminder of working and committing to our own journey of selflessness. So I thought I'd share that with you. It's a very beautiful idea. Okay, today, we're going to have a look at another Rosh Hashanah custom, or not custom, mitzvah actually, the shofar. Okay, so everyone knows that Rosh Hashanah, we blow the shofar. But why do we blow the shofar? Anyone?
Ram's horn.
Ram's horn, okay.
To wake up.
Wake up call, yeah. Anything else?
Tears.
Tears. Yeah, it's connected with tears.
No? Ram was sacrificed
for Yitzchak. Yeah. Okay, so first of all, it's a really, really important mitzvah. The Talmud says... Always gets the chesed and guru, right? Yeah, we'll get there. That's right, we'll get there. So, first of all, you should know that the Talmud actually tells us that mitzvat hayom b'shofar, the mitzvah of the day of Rosh Hashanah, the essence of the mitzvah, the essence of the day is, would you believe it, not apple and honey. That's a very important custom, but the mitzvah of the day is shofar. That's the mitzvah of the day. That's the essence of Rosh Hashanah, right? In fact, in the Torah, if you look at the Chumash, even though Rosh Hashanah has many names, in the Chumash itself, Rosh Hashanah is not the name of the festival. It's got other names. And the name that the Chumash itself, the Torah itself uses, is Yom Shu'ah, the day of Tru'ah. Tru'ah is one of the sounds we make with the shofar. We'll have to see later why it chose that sound particularly, but we'll see in a second, right? So it is an important, a very, very important part of Rosh Hashanah. So, I'm going to share with you some deep ideas, but let me just share with you some of the reasons you've said, and just very quickly go through some of the famous ideas of why it is that the shofar is blown. Here's a bunch of them. The Rambam, Maimonides, who writes about shofar, makes an interesting remark about shofar. He says that actually... he says we don't really need to look for a reason because it's a mitzvah in the Torah, so we just need to do it. But he said there are many, many reasons nevertheless. And his reason is the wake-up call that someone said before. It's like an alarm clock, a spiritual alarm clock. It's a call to the soul, to stir, to change, to not be caught in the slumber, as he calls it, of our old ways, and just improve a little bit and to upgrade. Right? There was a great sage, Rav Sadia Gaon. He was a 9th century sage. He writes and he gives 10, I'm not going to go through all 10 reasons, but he gives 10 reasons for the shofar. I'll just share with you a few. He says the famous one, that we know that one of the themes of Rosh Hashanah is a coronation, that we re-crown God as our king every year. And it was the custom that when, I think it's still a custom probably, that when kings or queens are coronated, it happens with trumpets or bugles or whatever the case is, and that's the symbol of the shofar. Another one he talks about is Mount Sinai. We know when God gave us the Torah and we committed to be His nation and He committed to be our God, there was a very strong blowing of a shofar at Mount Sinai when the Ten Commandments were given, and therefore we commit Rosh Hashanah, we remember that commitment of Har Sinai. The famous one, of course, is Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, comes up, it's a highlight theme of Rosh Hashanah, and we know that what happened was that when God said to Abraham, I don't actually want you to offer up Isaac on the altar, you can take him down, there was a ram in the thicket of the bush, Abraham offered up the ram instead, and the ram's horns becomes the symbol of the Akedah. Rav Sadia Gaon also writes that the shofar is a reminder to look forward to the Messianic era, the time of Mashiach, because the Pasuk, the Tanakh tells us that when Mashiach comes, God will blow a shofar gadol, it says. A big shofar will be that long tekiah, so to speak, heralding in the final redemption. Now, of course, the other commentaries say that the shofar is like a cry from the heart, and it's sort of a cry from a child wishing to return to his parents, to his father, and so on and so forth. Okay. So, before I take you on a bit of a deeper level journey of understanding this and learn some really important life lessons from this, I just for the sake of interest, I want to just share with you actually how shofar actually works, because I'm sure many of you have heard shofar, but what is actually the mitzvah? Like, how does it actually work? So I've got this slide here, which probably won't make that much sense to begin with, but let me just walk you through it very quickly, because I think it's interesting. So, because you know, we blow shofar a lot, like different sounds, and what are they all about? So, the original mitzvah of the Torah to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah is to do the following. The Torah tells us we have to blow a tkiah, a truah, and a tkiah three times, right? So, what's a tkiah? Tkiah is that long sound, right? Ooh, that's by that long line, right? And then there must be sort of a broken up sound in the middle called a truah, and then followed by another tkiah, and we need to repeat that three times. Altogether, nine sounds. In other words, tkiah, truah, tkiah, three times, right? The problem is that we don't know what the Torah actually means by the word truah, right? Because we know that truah represents some sort of cry, but we're not sure what type of cry. The Talmud says that there's three options. One is there are people that cry like more like it's a, what they call in Yiddish a krechts, which is like a bit of a longish, like, oi, you know, oi, right? And that's what we call today the shvarim, like tuhu, 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 right? Okay. Then there's some people that cry in hysteria, like the short sounds, which we call today trua, like tu 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 tu, right? That one. That's a symbol of a person like in desperation. Then there's some people that start with the krechts and end up in hysteria, right? So they start with a long, and then they go, oh, then they get anxious and they get into hysteria, right? So therefore, we're not sure which one it is. So we do all the options. What do we do? When we get up in the shul, the first time we blow the shofar, we blow tkiah, shvarim, truah, tkiah, three times. Then we do just tkiah, shvarim, tkiah, three times. And we do tkiah, truah, tkiah, three times. Just to cover all the options, right? Now, when you're in shul on Rosh Hashanah, they blow much more. In fact, they blow throughout the prayers and everything like that. But the basic mitzvah is to do what I just explained. That's why, if we ever blow for someone in the street or in hospital or at home, whatever the case is, we just blow the minimum amount. It's called the 30 sounds altogether, and that's to fulfill the mitzvah, and that's how the mitzvah works. But it's always based on this formula of having the tkiah, a long sound, smooth sound, something broken up in the middle, one of those three options, followed by a long sound, right? That's the way shofar is blown. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm just emphasizing it because I'm going to use it later on to understand a very deep idea. Okay. So, I'm going to share with you two ideas. One is a little bit more famous, and then I'm going to share with you a very fascinating concept based on, because I've brought some other things into it, but based on the writings of the Sfat Emet, which was the second Gerer Rebbe, the great Polish dynasty of Hasidic sect called Gerer. Okay. Don't you come from Gerer Hasidim?
No, I come from
Alexander Hasidim, that's what you told me. They were all same Paul, they were in the same place. Okay, the first idea of the shofar is the following, it's an important mindset going into Rosh Hashanah, that shofar is what we call a father and child or a parent and child reset. So there's a famous analogy, a famous parable that's given by the Baal Shem Tov about the shofar, that he talks about all good old parables always go with the king, right? So the king had a prince, and the king called the prince one day and said, you need to learn the ways of the world, so you need to go out into the big wide world. I'm going to give you some resources and some money to be able to make your way and go learn the ways of the world, and you'll become a stronger person. So the prince left, but the prince wasn't exactly behaving himself, so he squandered the resources, he messed up, joined bad company, drifted very, very far away from the palace, and assimilated and became part of the world, and even forgot that he was a prince of the king. And so much so, says the Baal Shem Tov, that he actually even eventually forgot the language that they spoke back in the palace. And then after many years, one day the prince suddenly remembered his father's palace and he yearned to reconnect. So he travels back to the palace of the father and he doesn't even know how to get in. There's guards, he doesn't look like a prince, he's disheveled, he looks like a completely different person. And he doesn't even know how to communicate with the authorities around the palace because he's forgotten the language.
Sounds like Prince Harry.
A little bit, right? Good analogy. So he comes back. I don't know if the ending is going to be the same, but we'll see. So he comes back and he's gesticulating and he's trying to get the parents. They look at him like, I'm a sugar there. Like who are you? Like, we're not going to let you in. He doesn't know what to do. And he's very upset and he lets out this big cry. And as he lets out the cry, the king is sitting in the throne room. He hears the cry of the prince and he says, that's my child. And he comes in and he embraces him and he welcomes him back into the palace. Said the Baal Shem Tov, we are the prince, right? Sometimes we lose our way a little bit. But when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, there's something very special that happens in Rosh Hashanah. You see, let me just explain a little bit. I think this concept I've explained before, but it fits into this whole idea. You know, one of the tefillot, one of the prayers that we keep on saying in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is Avinu Malkeinu, right? Avinu Malkeinu, our father, my king. We say it many times. In fact, I don't know if I told you this, but my father used to quiz me always when I was a little child. And he would say, this was a yearly trick question. He'd say to me, how many Avinu Malkeinu are there? So I thought he meant like how many sentences of Avinu Malkeinu. So I used to go and run the machzor and count them up. He says, no, my son, there's only one Avinu Malkeinu. There's only one father and one king, that's it. There's only one God. Okay, it was his way of teaching me that, right? Yes. So Avinu Malkeinu. But what's the formula of Avinu Malkeinu? So we know we have two relationships with God. Right? And this is a very interesting thing, and this is how the whole Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur process actually works. I'm going to say this briefly because I'm sure I've shared this before, but Avinu we have two relationships with him. One is a parent to a child. A parent to a child is an unconditional bond, right? And we know that because when we have a little baby that's born, it's always the cutest and the cleverest and the most amazing child, right? And the truth is that they're not, right? They're not. I'm sorry to break it to anyone, but they're not, right? When the child is born...
But it's true of grandchildren.
Yeah, for sure. Right, when a child is born, they do absolutely nothing. They don't even smile. They don't accomplish anything. We don't know if they're clever or not. But it makes no difference. So why they're so amazing? Because there's this unbreakable bond between a parent and a child, right? That's what happens. Now, that's the relationship when a child is born. That's the only love that's there. That deep and amazing, unconditional love, right? When the child grows up, the relationship shifts a little bit because that sort of deep, unconditional love goes into the background and the relationship becomes much more functional. We want the child to behave. We want the child to do their homework. We want the child to do well in school. We want the child to have manners. Whatever we want, right? And that sort of... that's the operation of the relationship works on that level. So that's more like a Malkeinu relationship. It's more of a king-subject relationship because it's like subjects of a king don't have an unbreakable bond with the king. It's more of a functional thing. You've got to keep the rules. You've got to accomplish. You've got to be a law-abiding citizen. You've got to be a productive citizen and so on, right? But with God, we have both relationships. But as a child grows up, the day-to-day operations work on the much more operational, functional relationship. And then the kid messes up. So let's say the relationship now between the parent and the child becomes very strained. And there's a distance between them. And that goes on for a while. So what happens? What happens is you need to reconnect. How do you reconnect the parent and child? In other words, how does the relationship rebuild? the only way the relationship could rebuild, because it's very strained and they're not on the same page and then the child's not doing it the parent wants and so on and so forth, the only way it can be rekindled is for the relationship to be stripped back all the way to the very beginning. You need to rediscover and reignite that unbreakable bond, that unconditional love that existed between parent and child to begin with. When everything else can just fall away, that love that's not conditional on behavior, that love that's got nothing to do with accomplishment or productivity or anything, can be rekindled and reignited, that can be the foundation to then rebuild the relationship. So that's the story of the Baal Shem Tov, that when that king comes out of the palace and he embraces the son can't even put it into words because he has no functional relationship with the father. The only thing he does have, he has a cry that comes from the very essence of the soul, that cry which represents that unbreakable bond that can never go away, notwithstanding how distant the child might be from the father, right? So that's Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is, like Rosh Hashanah, it's interesting, there's a famous question, how come Rosh Hashanah comes before Yom Kippur? Really, it should be the other way around. Yom Kippur, we should have Yom Kippur first, get forgiven, get a clean slate, and then go to the new year. And the answer is, it doesn't work like that. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is part of the same journey. But Rosh Hashanah, we don't confess, we don't talk about details, we don't talk about behavior. It's just Rosh Hashanah is shofar, that's all. Why? Because Rosh Hashanah, we reset the relationship. We take it all the way back to the Avinu, to the father and child, how it was when the child is a small infant. And we rekindle that unbreakable bond that exists between us and God. And we cry from the depths of our soul. That's the shofar. It's the prince calling, I want to come back home. And it's the father who opens the door and says, welcome. Now, once the child comes into the palace, obviously he's going to have to relearn to be a prince, right? And that's the second part. That's the Malkeinu. That's the Yom Kippur emphasis. Where we, okay, now we've been welcomed back, so now what are we going to do about it? And that's the commitment we make on Yom Kippur, hopefully to be a better person in the coming year, right? So that's the Avinu Malkeinu relationship, which runs through the whole process, but more with more emphasis. The Rosh Hashanah is perhaps more the Avinu, and the Yom Kippur is more the Malkeinu. So it's an important thing to understand because, yeah.
Why don't we sing Avinu Malkeinu on Yom Kippur when it's Shabbos?
Oh, so on Shabbos you only do it at Ne'ilah. So that's a halachic technicality, because on Shabbos, we outside of the Amidah, we don't delve into personal requests. And that's why we don't say Avinu Malkeinu for Shabbos. But when Yom Kippur falls out on the Shabbos, but we still do it at the end, like by the final moment we say it. So the concept is still there. Okay. So that's the thing. And it's an important thing to understand, because a person should never, ever, ever think that I'm too old to change, or I'm too old to be reaccepted, or I'm reconnected. God is always there. That Avinu is always there, and that's the shofar. That's why it's the foundation of the year. The foundation of the year, we get an opportunity to go all the way deep down, deeper than our functionality, deeper than our behavior, and reset the relationship, and that's the shofar. Okay. But I want to spend the rest of the time going through a very fascinating concept, which, as I said, was based on the writings of the Sfat Emet. So we have this term. Yeah, is everyone awake? Because it's going to be a little bit... You need to concentrate a bit, okay? We have this term called Kol Shofar, the voice of the shofar, right? In fact, the blessing we make before the shofar is we say that we make a blessing, we bless God, and we say that He's commanded us Lishmoa, to hearken, to listen to pay attention to, Kol Shofar, the voice of the shofar, right? And in fact, it's a voice which has no words, it has no content, it's just a sound. Okay. So where do we find the word kol? That's a trick question. No, that's not a trick question, I'm saying. I don't know if you will be aware of this, but where do we find the word for voice somewhere else in the Torah? Kol. Where do we find the word kol?
Kol nidre.
Yes, that's true, but it's spelled differently. Kol nidre, so that it means all. Kol doesn't mean voice there.
Oh.
Right? Kol shofar, yeah, in Matan Torah.
Yeah.
We actually find it very, very early on in the story of Yaakov, of Jacob. And it's an important reference. So, just to refresh everyone's memory, there's the story, the biblical story where our third patriarch, Yaakov, had to steal the blessings. You know the story of stealing the blessings? So Yitzchak was going to give this very special blessing to Esav. There were two brothers, Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov was the good guy, and Esav was the hunter, the gangster, the murderer, right? The tough guy. They were twins, right? So Jacob and Esau. Yitzchak was supposedly, he wasn't fooled, but he had a soft spot for Esav. Another question why, and he was going to bestow the blessing. Rivka steps in and says to Yaakov, you must go and get the blessings, because this blessing is very important and it's the destiny of the future nation. But he says, but the problem was that Yaakov was very smooth. He was a very smooth person. His complexion was very smooth. Esav was very, the father was a little bit blind, but he would feel. He says, my father's going to feel me when I come in, right? And that's going to be a problem. So she dresses him up with goatskins and a special garment of Esav that feels very hairy and feels, right? And he goes and he gets the blessing. And the whole story happens. Esav comes and he cries and Yitzchak realizes that was the right thing and the blessing was in fact destined to go to Yaakov and not to Esav. When Yaakov comes in, and he prepared for him a meal, that was the whole thing, he prepared for him a meal first, comes in to Yitzchak and he says, the meal is ready, please bless me, my father. And Yitzchak is suspicious because it didn't sound like Esav, right? He comes closer to Esav, to Yitzchak. Yitzchak says, come closer, my son, so I could feel you. And he does, and he says the following sentence. He says, Hakol Kol Yaakov. The kol, the voice, same word as Shafar, is the voice of Yaakov. But the Hayadayim, the hands, Yedei Esav are the hands of Esav. That's what he says. So on a very simple level, it was just a very practical historic story. He sounded like Yaakov, felt like Esav. Yitzchak was confused. It was almost like a question. He says, are you sure you're the right guy? He says, yes, and he gave him the blessing. But it's much, much, much deeper than that. All right, it's much, much deeper than that. And the word kol here is very, very important. So let me take you through a process like this. Let me talk about, and we'll come back to it, because we really need to understand, like Kabbalistically or on a deeper level, why was it important? Like, why did God construct it in such a way that Yaakov, who is our patriarch, we are called, Yaakov had two names, you know that, Yaakov and Israel, right? We are called Bnei Israel. Why? Because we are the children of Yaakov, essentially, right? So why was it important that it should turn out that way, that Yaakov should sound like Yaakov, he should have the call, the voice of Yaakov, but he should feel like Esau? Why? Like, that sounds really, really strange. There must be something deeper going on here, okay? All right. So let's leave Yaakov and Esau for a moment and let's talk about something else. We'll come back to it. So we've talked about many, many times that the human beings are called communicators, right? We're called the medaber. Speech, words is a very powerful tool that us human beings have. But we also know from Kabbalah that speech operates on two different levels. And the two different levels are kol and dibur. Okay? What is kol? Kol is the origin of speech. Now we know that the origin of speech is a very interesting thing. Kabbalistically, the origin of speech is very, very deep. It's the kol. When we say the word kol, we don't only mean a physical voice. We mean the origin of the voice, deep down within the human being. What does that mean? It means because the power of speech is very deep. The power of speech is the deepest part of the human being. I've shared with you once before that in the very beginning of Genesis, when God infuses Adam with a soul, right? And it says, "Vayipach be'apav nishmat chayim." He blew into his nostrils a piece of godliness, so to speak. That God infused man, he infused the human being with a soul, and that's a soul that we all have. And it says, "Vayehi Adam," the man became a living person. And the Targum, the Aramaic translation says, the man became a speaking spirit. Because Kabbalah says, "Hanefesh mele'ah otiyot." The soul, deep down in the soul, what's the essence of the soul? Filled with words, filled with the potential to speak. Now, why is that so? Why is like our deepest part of us the potential to speak? Because we've explained before that the power of speech is huge. Communication is what allows us to go beyond ourselves. Communication is what allows us to make connection with others. It allows us to navigate different worlds, different realities, different perspectives, different situations, different challenges, and it's the communication which allows us to build these relationships. It's communication which allows us to navigate very complex situations. We know that so many times problems come from lack of communication. When people don't communicate on all levels, in all ways, right? And communication, true communication, as we've talked about many times, can only happen with a human being, nothing else, even an animal. An animal cannot communicate, an animal can only broadcast signals. You remember that talk we once gave, right? It can only broadcast itself, it can't go beyond itself. Through communication, we have the ability to go beyond ourselves and to connect to the world of another. Ultimately, the world of another means the world of another human being, the world of God, the world of whatever it is, but we can go beyond ourselves, we can unleash and we can reveal the infinity that we have, not to be locked in ourselves, but to unlock the infinite potential that we have to go beyond ourselves, right? That's why the potential to do that is very deep down within our soul, and it's called kol. It's the origin of the voice, or as Kabbalah refers to it as the hevel halev, the moisture within the heart, which means the power to speak. But at that point, there's just potential. There's no actual words, right? It's just the power to connect. It's the power to build relationships. It's just the power to be infinite. At that point, deep within our soul, that potential to speak is very pure. It's connected with the soul. It's that part of purity within us, that godly part of us. It's not divided into different words and different sentences. It's just a potential. It's the kernel. It's the very, very pure power of infinity that we have deep down within our being. But to stay there is useless. So where must it come? Where must it express itself? The kol must transition to dibur. Right? Dibur is actual speech. Practical speech. Right? In other words, the kol is in the highest and deepest part of our being. The actual communication is outside of us. It's not even in the more conscious parts of us. It's the outside of us. It's the lowest level of our soul. It's actually going beyond ourselves in the outside world. The outside world that is very complex. The outside world that is very challenging. We know that practical and effective communication is very, very complex. Right? How many times we beat ourselves up because we said the wrong things, or we put our foot in our mouth, or we didn't have the right words to talk to someone with, or we didn't say the right thing, or someone didn't say the right thing to us, right? Proper, effective communication means timing. It means choosing the right words. It means navigating very, very challenging experiences and relationships and all kinds of things, right? To navigate real, effective communication is so hard because once we bring it to the forefront, once we go into the practical world of actual finding the right words, we can use the wrong words, we can let our ego get in the way. So many things can go wrong, right? So many things can go wrong. So the kol, when our power of speaking is still in its potential, it's very pure. It's the purity that we are born with. When it comes out to the world of dibur, it's very challenging and obviously often gets really messed up. However, it is through effective communication. It's when we use the words properly, when we navigate the challenges of the outside world and the complexity of relationships that we involve in and so on and so forth, and we manage to use effective communication, it's not just that the communication is so powerful, but it's the kol, that ability to communicate, that has now upgraded. Because the purity has now been brought in and integrated into the world of challenge. It survived. In other words, kol in its potential, in its original source, is an untested purity. When you can make it work in the world where there's conflict, where there's in a world where there's resistance to that purity, and yet you can make it work, that purity is comes out so much more powerful. So communication on the practical level is very difficult, but when you survive and you do it well, it's so much stronger. The soul becomes so much stronger on all its levels, even deep down. The kol becomes upgraded. Am I making sense so far?
Yeah.
Yep.
So what's to happen? So we've got a lot of people in the world that can't speak, or they can't speak
physically.
Physically can't speak and can't hear also, and they're some are just very inarticulate. So what happens to that wisdom that
yeah, no, it's a good question. So just two very quick things on that. So first of all, there's a difference between someone who's not so articulate or someone that physically can't speak. Okay. Someone that physically can't speak, it's a very interesting thing. There's a whole Kabbalistic, which I'm not going to go through now because it'll get us off track here, but about Moshe Rabbeinu, that he couldn't, you know, he was speech impaired before the Torah was given, right? And so we actually have a concept that when people, we don't know why God does this sometimes, like we don't know why God does lots of things, but when we have a person who can't speak, unfortunately, it's actually a sign of a very, very high and lofty soul. For some reason, he's not meant to operate in the outside world. Someone is not articulate, but we have to try and teach them and learn them to the best of their ability, right? However, it's not just about speech, right? This formula is really a much broader issue. It's a story of our life in general, this concept. So again, these two ideas, kol and dibur, kol being the purity of the soul, the potential to speak, and the actual practical application of speech, that formula is really the story of our life. Why? Because where did speech come along? Like this. So when we were first created, as I just mentioned, and the commentaries connect this with the shofar a lot as well, it says God blew into our nostrils, God blew into the nostrils of the human being, a soul, right? That soul, in its very infancy, in its beginning, is complete purity. That's why Adam and Eve, before they sinned, they were the most purest people, right? Adam was a symbol of purity. He was as the Kabbalah refers to it, he was the craftsmanship of God himself. God made him, right? It was the ultimate purity. However, the aim and purpose of creation is not to be pure. Or, putting it differently, it's not to live in the world of purity. Because if we had to live in the world of purity, God didn't need to make us. There's enough angels, there's enough spiritual beings, right? Huh? Correct. That's what we learn. We try and understand, right? But God wanted that purity to blossom. He wanted that purity to become stronger. He wanted that purity to be tested and applied. That was actually the mistake of the first human being. The very first human being sinned. When did he sin, by the way? What day of the year? On Rosh Hashanah, when he was created. Right? The day that he was created. He sinned because he was challenged. And she was challenged by the snake. The snake was a symbol of challenge. Right? And he couldn't handle it. Because Adam was purity. As soon as there was something else mixed into the mix, he fell apart. His whole world fell apart. Very pure, very holy. Didn't withstand, didn't tolerate the resistance from the world of the snake. And therefore, post-Adam, we need to fix this. Who started the journey of fixing this story? Listen carefully. Who started the journey, which we are still part of fixing what Adam didn't do and making it work? Jacob. This is what the Kabbalah tells us. Why? Because the Talmud says that Jacob, complexion, his countenance, his face, his beauty, actually, the way the Talmud puts it, was the same as Adam. Yaakov came to fix what Adam didn't do. What does that mean? Let's go back to Yaakov's brother. Esau, right? So Esau is not just a gangster. Yaakov and Esau are actually two parts of one formula, right? They're two parts of one formula. There's the world, we all have the world of Yaakov and the world of Esau. Our soul is the world of Yaakov. Our soul is purity. Hakol, kol Yaakov. It's the kol, not the dibur, right? The kol. It's the seed of purity. It's the foundation of absolute holiness. We all have parts of us. We have our soul. We have moments of Yaakov. We have moments where we feel very spiritual. We have moments where we are just in an uplifted, inspired mood. We have moments where we're like, you know, maybe it's when we say Shema, maybe it's by the Ilan Yom Kippur, maybe it's when we hear an amazing story, maybe when we're just on a high, whatever it is, we have moments of Yaakov, we have moments of purity, right? But the purpose of Yaakov is that then you have the world of Esav. Yeah. What's the world of Esav? The world of challenge. That's what the world of Esav represents. And we all have that. We all have an Esav, right? And the point is, and that's why it wasn't a question of Isaac. He wasn't posing a question, and he wasn't threatening Yaakov. He was saying what's supposed to happen is the combination. What I'm seeing, what I'm feeling, says Yitzchak, this is one interpretation. What I'm feeling is the way it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be v'hakol is kol Yaakov. It's supposed to be the voice of Yaakov, but v'hayadayim, but you're supposed to then go into the practical world. Where you're supposed to live and operate and make it work is the Esav, it's the hands of Esav. That's correct, that's a good way. That's supposed to be like that. Hard, complicated, just like speech, but it's true with the whole life. We have to take that purity and make it work in the world. That God put us by design into the world of challenge, into the world of temptation, into the world of egocentricity, in the world of complications and complexities. He put us into that world. And he says, now apply the kol in the world of Dibur. Make the Yaakov guide the Esav. No. We did exist, but they existed. But they existed. Of course, they existed. But they represent the people in the biblical heroes. The biblical people represent not just their own physical existence; they represent concepts as well. So it's not a contradiction to the fact they existed. But right? Because the world of Esav is there for a reason. Yaakov has to guide that world, right? Which is why Kabbalah explains that that's what Yitzchak's mistake was. The blessings can't go straight to Esav. They have to strengthen Yaakov, and let Yaakov guide the Esav. That's how it's supposed to work, right? And when we do that, when we take it from the kol to the dibur, when we take it from the purity, from the potential, from the undiluted holiness, and we apply it and it informs and it inspires the way we live in the world of challenge, where things are difficult, and we use that purity to say, no, I'm going to be strong, and I'm going to get less angry, and I'm going to be less egocentric, and I'm going to be more spiritual, and I'm going to overcome temptation, and I'm going to do another mitzvah, however we make it work, then that Yaakov, in the world of Esav, in the world where it's complicated, then the Yaakov, it's not that the Esav becomes transformed and elevated, it's the Yaakov becomes stronger. The call of Yaakov becomes so much stronger when it's applied in the world of Esav. Is it making sense so far?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is the story of Rosh Hashanah, and this is the story of Shofar. So, the way it works is like this. And this is what the Sfat Emes says. Remember I told you in the beginning, how do we blow Shofar? It's always a long sound, broken up sounds, and followed by a long sound. It's the story of our life. The long sound, the tkiya, is purity, smoothness. It's the original, it's the kol. Kol shofar. Right? It's the original, undiluted, infancy of smoothness and purity that the soul begins with and starts out with. Right? That's how life begins. Then as life continues, we get into the broken sounds. We get into the world of Esav, where there's applied communication, broken up words, complicated navigations, complex experiences, and so on and so forth. And we have to navigate it, and we have to overcome, and we have to withstand, and we have to apply those values that live in that very strong, original, potential speech, purity, that depth of the soul, and make it work. And if we do, then we blow another tkiah. And that second tkiah is the upgraded purity. It's the purity that emerges from transformation of negativity. It's the purity that emerges from surviving the world of challenge. It's the Yaakov becoming stronger when he's dressed as an Esav, because he's still Yaakov, but he's now, not like Adam who failed, it's Yaakov who's fixing that. We're in the world of challenge, but we make it work. We turn challenge into opportunity. We turn darkness into light. We turn, to go back to last week, we turn the sting of the bee into honey. Right? And that's how the shofar works. So when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, right? What do? We blow the shofar. It's the essence of the shofar. So how it works is like this. When it comes to Rosh Hashanah, we might reflect on the year gone by, which is what we're supposed to do around this time of the year. And sometimes we're a bit confronting. You know, maybe there were complications. Maybe we didn't survive as good. Maybe we didn't always withstand the world of Esa. Maybe we messed up here and there, right? So the first thing is we pick up a shofar and we say that deep, deep down, that original purity is never messed up. The original purity emerges in Rosh Hashanah. That's the first kiyah. So the first kiyah is we go very back, like I said in the first part, we go all the way back to the essential relationship. We go back to that original Rosh Hashanah. We go back to that original first 6 day of creation where God, vayipach ba'apa, when He blew into us that nostril, into our nostrils, that spark of life. Nishmat chayim, the neshama of life. On Rosh Hashanah, we say we're not overwhelmed about the new year. We're not overwhelmed about recommitting ourselves. We're not overwhelmed about our relationship with God, because we know that even if we might have slipped up here and there, that spark, that original tkiah, the first purity, the baby purity, the original soul purity is still there. It's there 100%. And on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we awaken it. We reveal it. We reignite it. We reconnect to it. It's when we reconnect to the very depth of who we are, that original reset button, that original purity, that original spirituality, that original Kol Yaakov, Kol Shofar. That's when we go deep down into that. But we know, and we commit to, we know that we're going to go into the world of the Shvarim and the Teruah, the broken sounds. We know that's only happening in Rosh Hashanah, but we're going back into the world. Going back into the world of Esau, we're going back into the world of complications and challenges. But on Rosh Hashanah, we also know that we have the power and we commit to making it work and work better than last year. Because we know that when we do, we're going to reach the second kiyah, that purity which emerges from transformation. Yeah.
So when the Messiah comes,
that's going to be the ultimate purity, because the ultimate purity, that's the shofar gadol that God's going to blow. That'll be the ultimate destination. But in the meantime, we're just going through it, right? And we part of that second purity, we experience every Rosh Hashanah, because as I said last week, we don't only discard the last year. We try to take the things that we learned from last year and we try to learn from them and transform them and channel them into a positive sort of experience. So that's why the shofar is the essence of what Rosh Hashanah is all about. It's reconnecting to the original purity. It's understanding that there is challenges, but it's understanding that the purpose of us is that we live. We're supposed to be the Kol Yaakov in the hands of Esav, but we make it work and we transform it and we channel that power of Esav into making it a new purity, which is unbelievable, which is the second tkiah. So that's why Rosh Hashanah, that's why it's such an unbelievable mitzvah and such a powerful mitzvah. I'm going to encourage everyone to make sure they hear the shofar in Rosh Hashanah, because it's a really important mitzvah. If you're not able to be in shul, there's other times you can hear it. Let me know. I'll definitely arrange it for you. I do want to make an announcement, by the way, while I'm about it. A commercial. I'm going to say a commercial break, but it's not going to be a commercial break. It's a commercial ending. And that is that I am going to be this year doing something different. We have our normal Bina services, but I'm doing this the second day of Rosh Hashanah. I'm going to be running a shorter Minyana service, Rosh Hashanah service in Vaucluse. It'll be sort of spiritual and with a bit of guided meditation, but of course the shofar. It'll be a shorter service, but hopefully very, very meaningful and deep. And if a person's anyway is going to shul, go to shul. But if you weren't planning to go second day anyway, as I know many people unfortunately don't, come along or let me know and I'll tell you the details. So it's probably going to be via Real Spirit's house. Okay. Almost for sure. That's why I didn't say the address, but we'll confirm. But there's a backup system, but almost for sure, yeah. So I just want to encourage, but don't only do it the second day. Make sure the first day also to hear shofar, because it's a really good way to start the year. It's a really powerful message. It's a really sort of foundational mitzvah of the year. And if I can just end off by once again, for those who came a bit late, just to remind everyone that when you're outside, please, you can stay as long as you want and talk as loud as you want. But when you're outside, please just try not to congregate in the area over there. Have a wonderful week. Oh, sorry, there's one more week. We're going to do this next week. The week after, I'm actually going to be overseas with my nephew's wedding. So we're going to end next week. And I'll be back for Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah.